labor hope, the dreams are old, the music sounds familiar, much between.
Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of consciousness, of our human possibilities, and that, of course, includes art, performance, music, dance, all the things that we are expanding into. And that's why I'm talking tonight to Carrie Behan. She's an amazing performance artist, singer, songwriter, dancer. Well, it's nice to have you on the show finally, Carrie. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Thanks, Alan. Hi.
Yeah, I mean, you do so many things. You're very diverse in your performances. So what is the main thing that drives you? What excites you these days? What do you want to be? Do you want to be known as a singer, songwriter, dancer, performer? What's your main focus? I know you said you have a one-woman show. Let's just talk about all of it. Let's talk about where you began. Like, how did you get into performance art and being a performer?
Right. I began in Berlin in Germany. I had been working in the German news department as a video editor for cultural program in the news. And I was in it from the mid-80s through to the early 90s. And during that time, I was actually a very frustrated artist that it had no chance to basically express myself in any way, having chosen a technical field for a profession. And as life would have it, I had a very severe injury and wasn't able to use the computers back then anymore and was forced to leave my profession as a video editor. And during that time, I started writing songs and I got together with a couple of musicians and I'd hum the melodies and sing them the lyrics, and eventually they put them to chords. And when I could, I'd play a plonky old guitar, but I had a hand injury at that time, so it took me a while to get going on that. And I put together a band, and that led to a lot of performances in the early 90s in Berlin, which led to my interest in cabaret. I was performing at a midnight show in the Berlin Variety Theatre, the Chameleon, back in the mid-90s at that point. And at that time, I became heavily exposed to variety and cabaret in the true sense.
But wait, let me just ask you, was there a theme to your music? Was there subjects that you focused on as a musician, singer, songwriter, performer?
Very much so. Throughout my work, the last 25 years, is definitely a relationship to my position of working amongst live news and producers, and there were several wars at the time, and the difficulties and the plight of man in general, and that does ring from my current work, which the nation of the last 20 or 30 years is actually about displaced people and working with the trajectories of people and incidents that I've incurred over the last years of living between these countries and singing and expressing and vocalizing about these.
The immigration crisis in Europe was what you were also...
Well, no, back in Europe, I was working with cameramen that had been sent into Sarajevo and Dubrovnik, and they were coming back shell-shocked and ruined, and we weren't allowed to air the footage back then because it was too graphic, but I would still see it and have to work with them, and then, of course, it wouldn't go to air. We used to buy from satellite the news that was being sent down, and I'd work with producers who could only show back that time very limited violent footage, so I was exposed to a lot of behind-the-scenes war. There was the Croatian-Serbian war, there was the first bombing of Baghdad, there was the Turkish-Kurdish war, which was really brutal back then, and we were doing a lot of coverage of it in that time. So this heavily affected my beginnings as a lyricist and what I wanted to write.
They were politically based songs then, in a sense, right? I mean, they were...
It was soft politics. I didn't dare go too far with it. I was a visitor in Germany. I did have a permanent residency, but I was still relatively careful about how I voiced things. And when I came to America, I've been extremely careful as to how I voice my artists. A lot of it is relatively soft or can be construed as being somewhat, you know, metaphoric. And lately I've been working with a former Czech Republic dissident. And the show that we have is about immigration and migration and displaced, but it really it it lends itself back to the times of when you were displaced because you were in exile, or you were actually fleeing from your country because of the regime there at the time.
So that's been a kind of continuous theme in your career then, huh?
Very much so. I was a runaway. I mean, I left a very safe country. It was New Zealand. I was definitely a runaway, and I've lived in five countries, and I've rooms and queues and 5 o'clock queues and being kicked out of countries and not being allowed in and all kinds of things that most people just wouldn't expect would happen to you coming from New Zealand. But you'd be surprised when you actually are sort of game enough to try and stay in places. And I don't have a green card here, so I go through this all the time.
But it would be interesting to hear one of those early songs in Berlin. Do you have anything that you could play?
Yes, I do. I think, sorry, I sort of put my album up on the iTunes for you, the new one, and didn't think to put up the old material. Let me have a look if
what's the name of that song?
One of the songs you'll receive is called Mothers. And I was, it was the night, the first day after they bombed Baghdad, and I was actually in New Zealand, and I had just come to take a break from working in the news in Germany, and I sat down and watched CNN for 3 days and just wrote down the rhetoric and then put this to Melody back with my band back in Berlin when I returned. So one was called Mothers, and the other one is Sado, which is about very early sort of my time working in London, where I was actually a pharmacy student working in a S&M store, and I didn't know what gay sex was at that point. So that's another interesting story.
Wait, tell me that story. That sounds very interesting, right? Wait, so you were working in an S&M gay store?
I was a student in London in the late 70s, early 80s, and a drama student. And to support myself, I got a job through a couple of fellow Kiwis in what they told me was a gay boutique that could sew. And I was like, oh, I can sew easy. So I went in, scored a job, and I was sewing leather in this rather peculiar boutique. And I didn't put things together because I was extremely naive until one day my boss couldn't make it in, and he asked me to open up the store because I'd always worked out the back. And that's when I opened all the cupboards and discovered the amyl nitrate and the dildos and all the stuff. And I was like, oh, what's this? I was a very curious student.
Were you surprised? Were you shocked?
No, actually, my brain works on the premise that I'm meant to be here for a reason, and obviously one day I'm going to write about this. That's all it said to me. This is interesting. Stay and have a look. However, remembering that this was the late 70s, early 80s, the 2 years that I spent working in that store sewing leather and the people I met and what I actually experienced, most of the staff were dead by 1984 to 1986. They were all the first victims of AIDS, and in the UK alone, 4,000 people died of AIDS between 81 and 84.
Did you write music about that? What was the influence on you?
Yeah, I did. In this show that I just did at Culture Hub La Mama, which is the one I hope to be presenting again early next year, I wrote a song called Palace Waltz, which was about my experiences in that store back in the early 80s. It's called Palace Waltz. It's actually not recorded.
But what kind of approach do you take in that song?
Tongue-in-cheek.
But from there, what happened? Where'd you go from the shops in London, you know?
Well, I had to leave London after a couple of years because the person I was with, his mother died, and we had to. And it was only while in my absence that they obviously all got AIDS, and then most of them passed away or were passing away as I returned to visit several years later. But I ended up in Australia and didn't return to London in any hurry because I decided to study behind the camera, and I wanted to become a camera woman. And I trained with Jane Campion, who won the Palme d'Or for the piano many years ago in Cannes. I trained under her several Australian directors, but I just switched over from being a camera woman to a video editor because the cameras were too big and they hurt my arms. And that's how I became an editor.
Tell me what you thought of Jane Campion as a person.
Absolutely divine. It was the first all-female crew. It was sponsored by the Australian Film Commission. There were 17 of us. 13 of them were feminists, and 3 of them were separatist feminists. And I didn't. This was before Jane made the piano.
You were just working with her developing.
She was one of the directors. Jane made a short film, which we were all working on, and she was one of 6 directors. And my time working with her, she was absolutely magnificent. She's a phenomenal leader, and she's very funny. And, you know, like, we were dealing with separatist feminists in our crew, which was hysterical because we needed a male grip to carry.
separatist feminist? What is that?
Alan, I'm going to have to take you out to dinner, and we're going to have a long talk about all of these.
All right. What is a separatist?
You're interfering with the book. A separatist feminist in the early 80s was somebody that wanted absolutely nothing to do with men in any form whatsoever, did not want to live with them, preferred not to associate with them, and preferred not to have to work with them in any professional arena, which made their lives impossible. And we had, it was the extreme, it was just, you know, the 80s, it was extreme. It was like, let's take feminism to the absolute ultimate place they can go. And they were pains in the ass to work with. And I was only one of the three straight people on the crew. The rest were all gay, which was fine by me. Jane was straight. I was straight. Jane is straight. And we were kind of like the odd people out. And we had it was great. It was a really good experience. But, you know, all of these things led. Anyhow, I went to Berlin after that. I moved to Berlin with a multimedia group from Australia. And that's where I spent 11 years in Germany.
Oh, so you got into editing there with Jane.
Yeah. I trained in that time with the Australian, with this particular all-female film crew. Then I moved to Berlin, and I was employed by German television and various houses pretty quickly back then because they had a big lack of video editors. They had film editors, but not a lot of video editors. It was a new age, new digital age back then.
But then you still wanted to be in front of the camera, though. I mean, you know.
No, I left drama school, and I went back down, and I directed a play when I was like 21 in Australia, and then someone said, you should try this. And I jumped behind a camera and I thought, oh, what a great excuse to not ever have to worry about being scared again. So I decided to become a technician, which was just a big, I think it was just me hiding from myself, because when I got a serious injury and couldn't edit anymore, I was forced in front of the camera. There was nothing left to do.
So let's then talk about your like career in front of the camera then.
Right, right. Well, it started in Berlin. You know, back then they only had big old VHS cameras, or if you were lucky, you could have someone come and shoot you with a, what's the name of this? Oh, the bigger cameras anyhow. And we used to record ourselves performing and playing just so we could monitor our shows with a VHS camera. But video clips were very rare. There was no YouTube. This is all pre-internet, you know, for a company in London or somewhere, because they were just too expensive. So we mostly dealt with photography and homemade VHSs that we just used to monitor our own shows, very low quality. And that was about all we could do. It was the early 90s. The rest of it didn't exist. So that's where I started.
You were still developing ideas. You were in the development stage of your thematic approaches to art, right?
With the multimedia group that I traveled to from Australia, we had these things called Bolix wind-up cameras, which were 16mm Bolix film cameras that we would chuck off buildings on ropes and turn the wind on, and made a lot of experimental films. And I actually took an old generic copy of a Steinbeck, which is a six-plate editing table. I took it on a container ship to Germany so we could keep cutting film. We were crazy. We were kids. We were absolutely crazy. We had no money, no food. All we cared about was equipment so we could make our art. You know? And we actually did multimedia shows in the 80s. In Berlin. So I already had a strong multimedia background. It was just, we were very restricted with what, unless we filmed it on 16mm or 8mm, you couldn't afford 35mm. There was just no decent way of really recording anything for a long time.
I remember Super 8 film. Actually, I still have a piles of Super 8 film with me that I definitely would love.
Yeah, I didn't use it much, but 16mm, we did 16mm because we were projecting it on theatrical stages and we needed a higher resolution with our imagery. But it was expensive. And like I said, we didn't eat. We were all very, very, very hungry.
Right. But you were making great or art. I didn't, maybe it was great, maybe it wasn't, but you were making art.
Yeah, you're aged between 21 and 28 with a bunch of artists, and you're driven. You're just driven. You're crazy.
Right. And so that's exciting, though, in a way, right? You were driven to...
I've got no regrets doing it. Yeah, I've got no regrets. And I do think the drive has definitely remained with me, because even now, like 30 years later, if I have a specific project that I'm working on, or a show I'm putting up, or a gig I'm going to do, or a video clip that I'm in, I'm manic. I'm like lost in that world until it's all done.
Well, so then let's come up to what you're doing now, you know, in your career and your, you know, music performance art career.
Well, I guess it goes in a big arc. doesn't quite meet again in a circle, but you take everything that applies, your knowledge, your relatively good knowledge of how the technical world works, in the sense that you understand the basics of where video and film came from and how it initially worked. You take that, you take your ability to stand on a stage, you take your ability to perform anywhere at any time, any place, and just absorb what's going on around you and respond to it. And then you use your musical ability. And I paint. I painted for a long time. I just went to this big pot. And now my passion is currently the show that I just did at Culture Hub called Alizone in the Quiet Room, Part One to Space, which is my theatrical show.
Slow down. It's called what, you said, exactly?
My name is the album that I'm promoting. It's called Alizone, A-L-A-Z-O-N, In the Quiet Room.
And what does that mean?
Well, an alizone is from, you know, it's from the old Greek standard plays. There would always be like three stock characters. You'd have the Iron, which always tricked the alizone. And the alizone was a braggart. And the alizone didn't understand irony, and it never understood the ironic situations it had already placed itself in and was living within. And it would get exposed by Iron. But in this case, I am the alizone, and I've taken myself into a quiet room, and this album is incredibly introspective and reflective over the last years about, you know, the mistakes I've made, the naivety that I held on to for so long, my faith in people where I placed it in the wrong people, my own need to live behind achievement or doing something in the art world as being the only way to live because I couldn't understand there'd be something else. And so, you know, I see the braggart in this alizone, and it's a reflection on myself, Alizone in the Quiet Room. So that's the album.
Wait, let me just understand the concept. Can you just repeat those things? The person who doesn't understand the irony, that's the what you're saying?
The alizone is a braggart and a fool who does not understand irony and does not understand.
Donald Trump would be someone like that?
I would say that he's at a different level, and there we'd be dealing with a different, completely different case. I think it would be easier to use another metaphor rather than him. Yeah, I don't know. No, I don't want to go there.
Who would be a good example of that?
Of an alizone?
Yes.
Well, I was.
But anyone that's known.
I wasn't pointing the finger at anybody.
No, but is anyone that we could see?
A famous alizone?
Yeah, like a well-known character or something.
What about Spicer? Spicer, the old former press secretary. He'd be a good alizone. Yeah.
Okay, I think I get what you mean now. Okay.
Spicer is definitely an alizone. Sean Spicer is an amazing alizone. He was behind his press conference.
Right. Now I know what you mean in a sense. So you were like that in your... This is a kind of summation of your... of your career, in a sense, where you're at now?
My life. Yes.
What does it mean, the quiet room? What does that refer to?
Reflection, introspective. The album's very, very quiet. There's only one. Yeah, and it's, you know, I normally do or have done either sort of slightly grungy cabaret, or it's pop with a very electronic slant to it, but this one has some soft electronics, it has a lot of acoustic, it has some beautiful piano and some sound effects, and it's my soft voice, a very, very quiet voice on most of them except one. My father just died, and he died in 2014, and I was very, very close to him, and he had a wicked sense of humor, and you know, we share that. And I lay on the floor of my studio in New York after he died, and I looked at my equipment, and I said, if you don't get off the floor, Ben, and write another album, you're never going to write one. And I really was dribbling and crying and take myself over to the keyboard and, you know, computer and guitar and sit down and start it. And then it just poured out, the last album poured out. And that was, we released it digitally last year in October with a record label and a distributor in London, but I didn't get the physical CDs until August this year, late July. So I've really just started making the little packages to send out to radio and things, because I don't really respond that well to digital. I love to work with something physical in my hands, and then and I can digitize it and off I go.
How many songs in this album then?
It has 10. One of them is there's a radio edit. So the last song on the album, song number, hold on a minute. Does it have 10 or 11? Hold on. Ooh, I've got it here right in front of me. One moment, please. It has 10 songs, and one of them has a radio edit. So it's really 11 songs, but there's two the same. One's just a shorter version. So numbers 1 to 9, and then 10 is the one electronic song, and then there's a radio edit of that because radio stations need a shorter version of a song.
What song do you want to play now?
I want to play Us in the Middle because that's all about being an Alizone, being stuck in the middle, being the fool, being the scapegoat as well. So I want to play you a song called Us in the Middle.
Okay, great.
Lo and behold, the dreams are old. The music sounds familiar. Much between men of dreams, their shoulders strong and linear. And I remain the extensions on stories that last minute flaws in the home it once would be. The carpenter sees his whiskey and sweet teas in slaps hard against my thinking. Bathroom bed and beds nowhere. This silent life is sinking. And I remain the ass in the middle. And I on stories and last minute flaws for the home it once would be. The carpenter sees his whiskey and sweet teas in home. And when it's gone, the water slaps hard against my thinking.
Is that you singing on there? Is that your voice?
Yeah. I compose them. I played most of that. I compose it. I write everything. And I sing it all.
What genre of music? It sounds very experimental type of, you know.
Yeah. I would say that you would classify my album simply as singer-songwriter because it has a mixture of experimental piano, piano songs, a little more cabaret, a little electronica. And there's even a touch of Americana. So it's just best to describe it as singer-songwriter.
Singer-songwriter. But is there something particular you want to express in that kind of style? I mean, it says something, that sort of way of writing music, right?
Well, my style varies. You'll hear it with the album. I can play you several different styles on this album. That's the whole thing about when with my work is that, you know, I definitely flit between the influence of varying genres.
Who influenced you on that song?
My dead grandfather. It was a dream. I was I had the dream in 1995 in Berlin, and I didn't understand it, but I wrote it down because I'd had another one from my dead grandfather, a visitation. I wrote the dream down, and everything in the dream came true in 2000, and just like late December 2013. I was like, what?
In that song, yeah. There is that in that is that dream?
Yeah. It's all about this dream I had and how I can't return to my homeland anymore, and how everything's been destroyed, and how I'm the ass in the middle, and that's a game you play, like Donkey in the Middle, where you throw a ball, three people, one in the middle and two people over the head, and the one in the middle has to try and jump up and catch the ball, and that's the donkey, the ass in the middle, and in my case, I couldn't catch the ball. Yeah.
So this is more, in a way, a form of you expressing your emotional frustration, right?
Very much so. Very much. In that particular song, yes. I can play you. You know, I can play you one about going to court, which is a piano song, which speaks for itself. Oh, that's Chandelier in a Rose. That's the story of, as you'll see eventually when the show's up again, part of displacement is obviously not just the displacement that we all know, the horrific displacement of refugee and war and emotional displacement, which if you talk to anyone that's came from a troubled place or, you know, there's emotional and there's financial displacement. And at the end, I dedicate the song Chandelier in a Rowboat to my deceased father, who went bankrupt many times with much joie de vivre and guts. And he was a very original person. And this song, he told me to put my chandelier in a rowboat and push off to sea as he was dying, basically, like take my stuff and go. I mean, in the nicest way, he adored me, but he was saying, there's nothing more for you here. I get your stuff and go. And I was like, gotcha, Papa.
In New Zealand, particularly, there was nothing more for you there.
No, not after he passed, not anymore. But maybe we don't want to play this to the New Zealand. No, this is it was a very personal story. It's related to family, related to generations of in-family disagreements and dysfunctionality and, a lot of financial issues and crazy Irish people, I guess.
Still, people listening to this, how can they relate to this themselves?
Just picture the concept of a chandelier. You're given a chance to get on a lifeboat and escape from somewhere. And what do you take? Do you take your passport, or do you take the most precious item you think is going to help you out on a monetary value? Like, and some...
We should do a music video of that.
I have a music video. I have a music video. My single music video is Chandelier in a Rowboat. It's on YouTube. Yeah. It tells the whole story. Yeah, I have a full video. It's also... Yeah, I have a full video to it. It's called Chandelier in a Rowboat. Mm-hmm.
But there's a progression to the songs on this album, right? You start off and then you're moving someplace.
I start off with Infinite Wisdom, which is my comment on the state the world is in. I then go to Ask in the Middle, which is a personal reflection. Then I go to a song called Can I Take the Thunder, which is when so much has gone wrong and it's so bad, but you believe in love and you believe in humanitarian help, and you believe that you can still be of good and value in this world and do something for other people. You can take the thunder. What happens to you, you can take it. So the song is called Can I Take the Thunder. It's all about if you lose everything and everything that goes. And then the next one is Poems of Achievement, which I actually dedicated to a documentary concept film I was doing about the Mexican wall being painted on the Mexican side by a group of school children headed by two activists that are very good friends of mine that I was staying with in Bisbee, which is a town near the border of Sonora Narco in Arizona. And they, for 6 years, had a project going where they were taking paint through the border and having all the children from this town in Naco paint the wall. And they'd done a mile of the wall, but Trump had it all pulled down. So it's all the paintings have been removed.
Is there a wall there now, or just a fence sort of thing, right?
What happened was they left up the skeleton of the wall, you still can't get through, but they had large iron sheets taken from a runway and placed on the wall. So, and these were the ones that for 1 mile stretch were painted by the children and, you know, various artists coming over from the American side. And this was just taken down recently, but the town then dedicated an entire building to this particular activist. So she's now running an art school for the children in the town, which is actually more powerful and giving a lot more access to children to actually have good art classes. So it went to a good place.
On the Mexican side, though, right?
Yeah, it's on the Mexican side. Yeah. Yeah, so I've been there several times. I was living in Bisbee. I had an artist residency during one of my shows. So I'd know everybody, and I went in and I filmed them. And then I'd written this song, Poems of Achievement, which is just the belief that something, it's a very personal song, but it's the belief that you step outside of your sheltered place that's kept you secure and you take a look and maybe you can put your hand up and believe in something again. And I felt very inspired when I was down there with these people doing this wonderful work.
All aside, I was wearing well badges of appeasement. All along I was holding tight tokens of allegiance in the face of averting of my consequential candor. I could read like an open book, oh, but my anger, all along I was quoting from poems of achievement. All along I was holding on to something to believe in the face of averting all. They simply
Is that the final song on the album?
No, that's only number four.
Well, how does it develop then?
Next one's called Steeple Afloat, and that was a dream I had when I was still working in the editing in the German television stations. And it was before the Berlin Wall collapsed, and I was living in West Berlin, and I fell asleep on the floor in a really sort of apocalyptic dream state. And I dreamt that tanks and elephants went to war over the East and West Berlin border. And, you know, villages and towns were flooded and steeples were broken off the tops of churches and people were climbing on cannons trying to save themselves from drowning. And there were rafts everywhere with people trying not to drown. And it was a very disturbing dream. I wrote the dream down, but I only put it to music this year. So last year. So this is the first time we actually officially recorded a song called Steeple Afloat.
Swords sitting on a steeple. Swords sitting on a steeple. Buzzards circling in retreat.
Buzzards circling in retreat.
All the clouds.
All the clouds
were on a tree of steel. And as it took upon, the form of tanks and elephants at war, the mighty horn, let the cannon be pulled. The winds arose and swept.
The winds arose and swept.
The roofs away. A heaven lurch and fashion.
I go to a song questioning God, and it's dedicated to my father, who was a So he didn't even become an agnostic. He just went the full Monty, but I'm sure he switched back just before he passed. But anyhow, it's a song questioning the presence of God. I was brought up a very strict Irish Catholic, so it's pretty easy to take it to that place.
I see. So, okay, but going back to the album, yeah. Where do you go from there?
Then I go to Mysteriously, which is a song. Then I take you back to many, many years ago when I read a newspaper article about a defected spy, a Russian spy who died, and he had defected in New Mexico sort of like 19 years before his death. And there was this very small newspaper article about his death. And I'd just been reading a book about a British spy that was sent into Russia, and he was actually murdered by his own people and poisoned with alcohol poison. And then I went to Sofia in Bulgaria because my friend's husband was murdered. And I attended a funeral there where there were, you know, there was definitely Bulgarian mafia, and he'd been killed because of something to do with that. And I wrote this song called Mysteriously, which is about these three characters and their deaths. It's a very slow drone. It's almost a spoken word.
But how does that relate to your life story, in a sense?
I spent time in Berlin with people that were writing either spy novels, researching a lot about spies. And don't forget, this was still the 80s, so the Cold War was not that far behind you. And it had a big influence on me. And also, don't forget, we were crossing into East Berlin to get Russian cameras and supplies. And, you experience.
How did you sneak into East Berlin, or could you go back and forth?
No, you can't. No, you would have been shot. You would have been shot if you tried to sneak in. You could go in for 24 hours if you had a certain passport. They didn't know the politics of New Zealand, so I'd always be kept for an extra hour while they grunted around trying to work out what kind of government we had. The Australians would get in a little faster than me. And you could go in for 24 hours, and in that time you hid the money in your underpants or your shoes because you were meant to take in 25 Deutschmark.
And then in the next song, as you go through that, then what happens?
Then we're back in New York, and I take you to a song called King of Honoring Nothing, which is a very personal song about the irony of ending up in domestic court against somebody that you trusted. And it's a very personal song, you know, about what can happen.
So you're moving. And then, are you moving in forward in time in your life in this as you lay out these songs in a way, or no? You're going back and forth a little bit.
No. This we place the songs together more in a curve of how they work musically. If we'd place them as to a time, people wouldn't know that information's not on the album, and it would the album is chosen for its musicality. You listen to it and it sounds like an album. It has a start and a finish, and it definitely has a beautiful flow. If we put it in, you know, sort of correct, had nearly the flow that it did, that it does.
How do you end it all, though? What's like the last couple of songs?
Well, the second to last song is called I Came a Cropper, which is all about, once again, being an Elizone, just I came a cropper. I think it may be an old British, Irish or British term. It just means, you know, you come a cropper, you fell off your bicycle or you fell over and your parents says, oh, they came a cropper, C-R-O-P-P-E-R. It's basically you fell over, something happened to you. And my life was a bit about I came a cropper, you know, always so close to aiming for something that I wanted to get and then falling flat on my face. And so that's about that. And that's because I didn't understand what was going on around me. I didn't understand what was happening around me and the irony of situations and what people are scheming and doing around you.
But yeah, so you were, it's just like you're awakening in a way, right? Is that what you're saying?
Awakening and saying that here's the Elizone, how stupid I was, and I certainly came a cropper, but there's no one to blame except myself because this is just the journey, particular blueprint, this particular incarnation I have and what I've got to get through. And I'm so grateful for all these artistic skills that have been gifted to me. And then I end with Chandelier and a Rowboat because it's, you know, Chandelier and a Rowboat is basically, you know, I push off.
You are the chandelier and the rowboat, basically.
It's actually a lovely way of looking at it. It's just about pushing off, not being afraid to go out into uncharted waters. You don't know where you're going to land, but you're willing to just take whatever you can with you and go do it. And that's what I'm currently doing. I'm actually applying for permanent residence in America at this point in time and renewing visa after visa and spending thousands and thousands of dollars trying to even stay in the country.
Right. But tell me, how do you put this all into a performance art piece? Aren't you making this into a performance, you said?
It already has been. It's a show. I've already performed the show once in Berlin and three times in America. I do it in conjunction with a gentleman who defected from the Czech Republic in 1978. And I tell the story of his trajectory across through Italy, France, and into America, and mine from London over to America. And in that time, through the songs, I get to tell the story as, like, these songs are not in order, but I use songs from much earlier albums and I use films from earlier performances. And I tell a story of his trajectory and mine and how we met up and how we actually ended up writing a musical together.
Was that musical?
And the musical was called The Kingdom of the Rusty Red Whistle. It was he's the director of the Czechoslovak Marionette Theatre, which basically houses puppets from the former Czech Republic, some of them, you know, over 100 years old. And he's been working here for over 20 years doing theatrical performances with puppets and performers, large-scale ones, you know, like life-size as well. And we wrote a musical together about a kingdom that existed that had no war, no famine, no hunger, no dissension. And there was a princess who was bored because she hadn't experienced any of this. And so we wrote this very tongue-in-cheek satire about the situation. And that was one that we had two films screened at this festival in Cannes called the Art Video International Film Festival. So we had 2 years running and had my other film, Folk Tales of the Monarch, and then this particular one screened here. So that was good.
What is it about this country that makes you want to stay here? I mean, that you like so much as far as being an artist?
People, I love the people.
People are from everywhere.
Everyone and anyone that kind of lands here that's been through any kind of trauma or is, you know, an migrant from anywhere, they understand humor. They understand what tenacity. Nothing's been gifted to them. And I surround myself with so many people that have had to fight hard to get what they want, and I just adore it. I've been in places where people are relatively complacent and expect their country to somehow look after them. So I just find it, there's never a dull moment, and every time you meet someone, you look in their eyes and you know they're going to have the most heart-wrenching story to tell you somewhere in there.
But what do you think, you know, performance art is sort of what you are. How is that, like, different than theater and in a way more valuable? I guess what I'm saying, it's sort of a personal journey. Is that what you would classify performance as opposed to theater?
The performance art that I've done has always been very much, I never used to rehearse. I would placed in a costume in a situation by a curator called Shalom Newman. We did a lot of it at a place called the Fusion Arts Museum, which used to be down on Stanton Street. And they had a history of performance art over the last 20 years in the Lower East Side. And I was working with him, and basically he would just throw me into these situations. And I found that less I knew, the more I had to instantly respond to the surroundings, the situation I was placed in. It was the most compelling and thrilling way to go as deep and as far as you can as an artist very quickly to see what you can contribute to this situation. And you have no time to consider it. It's just, and I it takes a certain person to be a performance artist. Some people need to be rehearsed and know exactly what they're doing, which is what you have to do when you stand on a stage presenting any kind of show. But performance art can often be an instant response, not always, but often, and that's very interesting for me.
What do you think the purpose of art is? Why do people have a need for expression? Why, in a sense, are you doing this when most people just sit with their, you know, memories and situate? What is it that you're compelled to share? I mean, why?
You know, as an artist, it's a part of you. It's in your DNA. you respond to this and you want to do it, as far as what other people glean from it, I think you could ask that question of anybody that goes to a museum or an art gallery or a show and they're not an active artist.
But you feel compelled to share.
Well, they watch or they look.
As an artist, you're compelled to share, and because the other people will gain value from your experience.
They may or they may not gain value, but you are compelled to share how you're going to respond in your environment and how you respond to it artistically. You're compelled, that does any form of art, is doing so. How the viewer absorbs it and what they reflect and take from it is entirely a different process, and it's nothing you can control.
But still, you have a need to express. The artist has a need, a compulsion to express nevertheless.
I think it's a healthy compulsion. I think most creatives feel compelled. If you weren't feeling compelled, you wouldn't have any drive. And if you haven't got any drive, your work is going to be relatively laissez-faire. It's going to, you know, I mean, it's the drive and the energy behind that inspires us, I would say.
I think we all have that need to express. That's why we are born with an ability to speak as opposed to animals. But most people don't activate that artistic compulsion to express. But I think it's a basic
union. Well, it's often suppressed. You know, there's so many times in trauma where people have worked and allowed people that have been in severe trauma to paint or draw something out or get involved in a theater production. My girlfriend DJs on Rikers, and I was watching a documentary about this amazing theatrical show that had been put on Rikers by the professional theater people working with them, and what it brought out in them and how it helped them resolve and solve and assess life in a different way. I mean, art in all forms, it wakens up trauma as well as beauty.
It awakens and helps integrate it. Would you say these stories, songs about your life is also a way of you integrating your experiences deeper and more coherently into your psyche?
Very much so. I mean, every time you sing it, every time you perform it, every time you play it, you're on a rewind that is by no means a shallow rewind. It's just pulsing again through your system. And very much so, Alan, I would totally agree with you on that.
Uh-huh. So should we play another song? What song would you like to play from this album now?
Well, it sounds like you want to hear a little bit of the Chandelier and the Rowboat, which is the electronic one. Let's go get it up. Okay, let's try.
With love, fell into the sea with every inflated load that he tried to cover up with all the guns of the road. But some punk at a bedside bankrupted his wife in the last tears of dignity. Slid down on a hospice floor. Studying your chandelier in a rowboat and push up the sea. Read your daddy's books and die on white shoes, yeah. Put your chandelier in a rowboat and push off to sea. Read your daddy's books and die on white shoes, yeah. He carved out more years. Pipers, bullet holes with oilcloth and sandpaper. The tearing tools were all still plugged in, cause he did it when that financial war beat down his door. And in his last days of dignity on his deathbed, he surveyed the back and said, my dear, no tears. I suggest you in a rowboat and push off to sea. Read your daddy's books and die on white sugar.
There you go.
What are you doing to your voice there? Is it through a filter of sorts?
I'm singing. I've got a relatively high sort of folky voice, but this is a raspy lower range that I have. So it's just a really low range, and I probably sing it twice, and then I layer in my own backing vocals. And then one of the tracks have a very raspy effect when it's in my lower tones.
Oh.
And then to give you a comparison of that, I'll play you a tiny little bit of King of Honor and Nothing, which is the other end of the spectrum.
Okay, is this one of the, is this the last song? No.
Oh, this is about being in court. But it do another whole spectrum of the voice, that's all. Okay. So that's a little bit of King of Honoring Nothing.
Well, I hear your cabaret, Berlin cabaret influence. And
Yeah. And Oh, no, I just can give you these tiny little snippets of a few others, like 20 seconds, and then you'd hear the different voices. It's up to you.
Yeah, do that. Yes, go ahead. I want to hear.
So this is Poems of Achievement, which is pretty much Americana, my form of. And this is the one about the kids at the Mexican border. Right. Hold on, let me jump in there a bit.
All along I was quoting from poems of achievement. All along I was holding on to something to believe. In the face of a fat tail, my consequential sorrow, I would tread to the box named Ray and fight tomorrow. My hope is renewed and startled anew. Say you want to.
So that's Poems of Achievement.
And then how do you end the whole thing? What's the resolution?
For what?
For the whole album, in a sense. Where does it, how does it?
Well, the resolution is, you just put your, it ends with a radio edit of Chandelier in a Rowboat. So basically it just says, you know, go out into, don't be afraid. You don't know what's coming, but just do not be afraid. Go out there and put your chandelier in a rowboat and push off. Don't be scared.
Mean, what does it mean? collected his wine, the last tears of dignity.
The Alizon then goes out into the world in order to learn.
She's no longer an Alizon. She's taken that final leap into maturity. She is no longer an Alizon. She understands finally the complexities of her life to this point, and it's been an enormous learning curve. And all she wants to do is be with other people as they get there with their road and reach out and share. She's a much, much, much better person for all of this.
Are you saying this about yourself?
One would hope. If you're an Alizon and you go into a quiet room and you reflect, what do you do when you come out of the room? You're either going to be a naughty child or you're going to understand that that was a growth spurt and now you've got to, you know, be a grown-up. It's a tough world out there.
So where do you go from here then? Where's your robo taking you?
I will put on my show, Alizon in the Quiet Room Displaced. We will start working to put it on in New York. At the moment, I'm not doing any theatrical performance. Currently just sending out this album to, you know, community radio and interesting radio shows that might want to do interviews or talk, obviously non-commercial ventures. And working with the release, I have a record label that would love to see me more active with what I'm doing. So I'm now sort of being a responsible musician for a while.
So how would you classify your art then and your music? What would you actually call it?
Oh, God. You know, I'm not somebody that can do the 10-second pitch in the elevator.
Would you call it experimental?
Because none of it has been done before. I mean, I'm just using oddball chords or the way I may intonate or something, but it's all been done before. So I don't think I'm experimenting with anything. I think it's just a singer-songwriter. I'm a singer-songwriter with my own. I have my very own strong signature sound. No one sounds like me, and I don't sound like anyone else. And I'm a singer-songwriter, multimedia artist. I can't think of an umbrella to put it under.
No, that's good enough. I just heard the whole entire Steve Reich. You know who's Steve Reich? He did the Trains. You know that album Trains from like World War, from Berlin in the war, World War II. He took all these train sound illusions and put it together in a kind of a huge soundscape. That sort of reminds me of some of what
you were. Sounds gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a great. I just heard the whole thing on WNYC driving in this rainstorm, and
I take that as a high compliment. Thank you.
Right. Do you know that piece? Do you know his work?
No, but I'm going to go look it up as soon as I get off the.
Because it's quite a soundscape, and I think, but I think that's what you're creating. You're creating a soundscape of experiences, not just listening, but you want people to actually feel. I mean, music does make people feel, but feel it more viscerally than. That's a pretty song. You're doing something else here. You're upping the ante. You know, you're giving the experience as opposed to just sitting back and having people listen. You know what I'm saying?
Well, what you've just done is you have now and you will be quoted for this, but you have now become the front page of my website, because I'm going to go onto my website tonight and put that this is a soundscape of experiences, and then quote Alan Steinfeld, because I think I've never heard someone so succinctly describe what I'm trying to do or what I am doing, and I thank you so much. It's perfect.
Oh, well, you're welcome. I'm happy to be quoted. Don't forget to say new realities, the show.
I will not. Not just that, but now I've got my elevator pitch. I've never had one.
Well, that I'm really happy about that, because I've tried to put it all together and sum up, because I know it's difficult to talk about art, because you just do it. Your song, it's like you can say it means this and this, and but you don't want to limit people's possibility of interpreted experience, because it's you're just the source of it, but what people do with it and how they relate to it, you know, is what they do. But and that's the value of art, is that it relates to each one of us in our own particular way. So yeah, I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all this. So thank you, Carrie.
Oh, I've wanted to do it for so long. We had a wonderful painting made together of us. I hope one day we get it finished. Remember?
That somewhere. Maybe you could use that in one of your performance pieces if you want.
Did he give it to you? Oh, that would be amazing. Wow. Yeah.
Of it. I have a photo. I'll send you a photo of that picture. Or maybe...
I have it. I have a photograph, yeah. We should do something with it one day. Yeah. No, thank you. Yeah, let's do a performance with it. I would love to. I'm such a fan of you and your work and the panels you put together. I've been on one of your panels, which I really enjoyed.
It was a poetry performance panel, right?
Yeah, but stunning people. People that would you had wonderful people on it. It was such a great panel. I was really appreciative of that. But anyhow, I've always wanted to do something with you. So
well, we'll do
this,
more, okay? We will...
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. So how can people find you then?
It's my name, Carrie Bien. So it's Carrie, Carrie. And my last name is Bien, Beehan. And my website, it's carriebien.com, everything. Yeah.
Like buy this album or download it or listen to it.
You can get it on iTunes. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on tons of digital platforms. But if you want a physical album, the label only printed a few, and I have them and I send them out personally. So then you just go on my website and there's a link for that. So you can either get a physical album or you're buying one through the record labels, like the digital platform. Either or, just whatever you want. And you can also... you can find me, like, if you just type in Alizone in the quiet room, it'll come up, because nobody sort of has claimed that for any other particular show at this point.
Well, that's good. Well, but thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for being on the show and sharing your in a way, your life's experience here.
And I do apologize for some of the sordid, the sordid parts of it from the early days, but hey, I apologize for some of the sordid parts of it.
No, don't apologize for that. It's all part of the human experience, which is what we're here to learn about. So I think it's all great, and it's a vulnerable space for you to share some of that. But
I've been sharing it for a while now. I'm used to it. I've reached a point where it's like, if you want to know where my work's come from, then where I went, because you know this is I'm not. This is real stuff. This has really happened. You know, it's real. Yeah.
No, it does seem real. And then
I don't know songs.
And then to express it in an art form, I think, is a way of sharing it. And supposed to, you could tell the story or you can have people experience it through theater and music. And that goes deeper than just, I think,
right? Yeah.
Just talking about it. But
yeah.
It's a way in. Well, thank you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Alan. And you're now going to become the quote on the website. I love it. Thank you. Thank you. Precious. Thank you.
I've been talking to Carrie Bien and her new album, The Alizone in the Quiet Room. It's going to be released October 21st. Is that what you're saying?
No, the digital's been out since October, but the physical is now released. So you can get it. You can get it everywhere on my website.
Alizon in the Quiet Room, about her life's experiences and through music, performance, art, and interpretive music. It's exciting. So, okay, we'll be in touch. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and you can find me at newrealities.com or youtube.com/newrealities or right here on bbsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
All along I was holding tight, tokens of allegiance in the face of averting of